This is Stand to Reason's hashtag STR Ask podcast. I'm Amy Hall, and this is Greg Kokol.
Hi, Amy.
Greg. Okay, let's get right into this.
Yeah, let's do it.
Enabled by Him asks, would you attend a church that is focusing on, quote, pursuing God's presence this year? Hearing God's voice through various means is being encouraged. If we ask questions about the biblical basis, we get told that we're missing out and stuck in our head.
Okay, this is not a good sign. And what's not a good sign in this particular case is not that they're encouraging people to hear the voice of God. Okay, the presence of God, that's great. You know, there's a book by an old book, been around for a long time, and I read it when I was a new Christian, Practicing the Presence of God, Brother Andrew. Is that his name?
I think it was Lawrence. Oh. I'm not sure, but
wait, ahead. Brother Andrew is the guy who was behind the Iron Curtain.
Yeah, so I think it was Lawrence.
Okay, Brother Lawrence. Anyway, but the title is there. And I don't recall at the time, and I could be mistaken, it's not a very big book, but I don't think, can't say for sure, but it doesn't strike me that this was included the idea of getting personal revelations from God, like God speaking to you, okay? But practicing the presence of God, good topic, all right? I think this is one of the values of having a day of prayer and fasting at different times, because you are committed to being focused the whole day, even though you're involved in other activities, to be before God. And I think the more that you practice being before God, practicing the presence of God, the more you are aware of being, what is it, coram Deo, in the presence of God. There's a Latin word that, coram Deo, I think it is. It means in the presence of God or before God or something like that. It's great. So I'm all for that. I am concerned if people are thinking that the way to do that is to experiment with different ways of getting God to talk to you personally, because this is not a biblical teaching. I'm not going to get into that now, but this is I think, seriously problematic. And I'm not saying it because I'm a cessationist. I almost said sensationalist. I'm not a cessationist. I don't think all the gifts are gone or whatever. And God can do whatever he wants. I'm not saying what God can or can't do. I'm just saying, what does the New Testament, especially, or any of the Bible really, but especially focusing on the New Testament, because now we have the New Covenant where we're given the Holy Spirit in a unique kind of fashion, does that give us liberty to think that every Christian is going to have this conversational relationship with God? And the answer is absolutely not. And virtually every verse that is pressed into service to that end is taken out of context. And I've written on that, Does God Whisper, the small book we have. Okay, so this troubles me about a church. I'm glad that they want to focus on the presence of God. I'm troubled that they're into hearing the voice of God, but there's a whole lot of churches that do that. Here's what really bothers me in this case, is that when you try to push against the status quo in a principled, gracious way, you are kind of trumped with spirituality. Francis Beckwith, who I wrote a book with a number of years ago, he's a funny guy, and he's got these little quips, but he had quipped once, when Christians disagree with each other, a tendency is to try to trump you with spirituality. So maybe if you and I disagreed on something and then I said to you, Amy, well, my God is obviously bigger than your God, okay? That's just a snarky way to trump people with spirituality. Oh, you disagree. Well, see, now you're quenching God's spirit, okay? I'm not going to quench God's spirit the way you're quenching God. There's no place for this kind of nonsense. Unless it's genuinely a sin, but that's in question here. But that's not what's going on here. It is at best a controversial idea that every Christian can get private revelation from God. And so, if there are contrary points of view, why wouldn't one entertain those in order to find out what's actually true? It's the sign of an unhealthy Christian to silence criticism, or critique would be a better word, of their view, by that Christian belittling the other one for holding the view. And by trumping them with spirituality is just another way of belittling them, all right? If you can make your case scripturally, fine. Then do so. If you can't, and all you've got is a trumping with spirituality, that's a pretty good indication you got nothing but hot air and abuse, which this is a passive-aggressive spiritual abuse. That's bad for individuals, but if this is kind of the tenor of a church, this is very bad for a church, because that means that this church, it is the majority that is always going to rule in that church, even if the majority is wrong, because the majority, that's the reigning views, is going to silence the minority, even if the minority has a principled concern here, and maybe the majority is correct. This is not the way it's supposed to happen in the church, and I'm troubled to hear this. If this, in fact, is the way it's going, that people aren't willing to listen or consider, and if our questioner wants context, get the booklet that we sell, The Ambassador's Guide to Does God Whisper? Because mostly what I do there is not make the case that God doesn't whisper, but I look at all the verses that people use to suggest that he's whispering and we aren't listening, to show that that's not what these passages are talking about at all.
I think the Ambassador's Guide is called Ambassador's Guide to Hearing the Voice of God, maybe, and then on our website it's under Does God Whisper?
Okay,
yeah,
either
just
way,
just so people know where. They
all can right,
find
what
it.
Do I know?
Because it is really good. I think you go through everything and you respond to a lot of criticisms that people have of your view, and mm-hmm. I think it's really helpful.
You know what I think though is strong about that book, and pardon me for saying it sounds like I'm waving my flag, but it's really the strength of the text and not so much of the book. When people are forced to look at the context and simply walk through, never read a Bible verse, that's our principle, read above and below and see what's going on, it becomes self-evident that these verses are not verses that support what people are supporting when they proof text these passages. Mm-hmm. It's not tricky at all. That's why I encourage people to take a look at it.
Here's a question from iMatt B. What is the best way to deal with someone who tells you that because you're not a certain identity group, you'll never understand their point of view? I guess this would be similar to saying men can't comment on abortion.
Well, I mean, in that particular situation, it was five men that made the decision that women had a right to an abortion, you know. So, okay,
But what would you say to someone who said, you're not this particular identity group, therefore you can never understand my point
okay, well, this is a case where the first Columbo question is completely appropriate. Well, I'm not exactly sure what you mean by that. Are you saying that if I'm not part of an identity group, I don't experience what that identity group experiences? If I'm not a black, then I don't experience what a black experiences? Well, that's not controversial in the slightest bit. Of course I don't experience what they experience. And by the way, one black's experience is going to be different from another black's experience. This is true about humanity in general. So if that's what they mean, that's not controversial. But usually what the claim is that someone that's not part of the identity group can't weigh in on the values related to this discussion, okay? And this isn't true at all. Unless the values are utterly and completely dictated by something related to that peculiar group. When I say peculiar, I mean not weird, but distinct. Just got to clarify here so people don't get it wrong. I'm hard-pressed to think of an illustration of that. But to go to your point a little earlier, you're a man. And therefore, what do you don't understand the trials and tribulations that a woman might have thinking about getting an abortion? Okay, yes, maybe you're right. I don't experience the difficulty of having an unwanted pregnancy. You're right, but that is only relevant if wanting to have the pregnancy or not wanting to have the pregnancy is the only factor in making a decision here. It's clearly not the only factor, and let me just offer an alternative. You Northerners, who don't own slaves, you have no idea what it's like to be a slave owner and to profit from slaves. None. Well, that's true in that narrow sense I was talking about. But if then the point is, and therefore you have no right to weigh in with your viewpoint on this, because you can't relate to our identity group being white Southern slave owners. Now, of course, this is so obviously ridiculous because the issue isn't whether you have a self-interest. The issue is it has to do with the nature of being human. And what's the appropriate way to treat human beings regardless of their color? And by the same token, when it comes to abortion, the question isn't whether you have an interest in getting rid of this pregnancy, which is just a euphemism for killing the baby, the unborn child. Of course you have an interest in killing the unborn child. That doesn't tell us whether it's right or wrong to do so. And whether or not it's right or wrong is utterly irrelevant to whether or not you have an interest. I don't have that interest. It's not my baby, and I'm a guy. But I still know it's wrong to kill little children. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter whether they're inside the womb or outside of the womb. This is identity politics. This is one way that the identity politics nonsense goes so far south. It almost sounds like a pun, but it not meant by like that. So awry, you know, that it's borderline laughable, except for that people take this kind of foolishness seriously.
This just speaks to the damage that postmodernism has done to our society. If we are all in our own little groups and we have our own language and our own experiences and there's no truth outside of everyone that we can appeal to in order to bring people to our point of view, there's no outside truth. Therefore, your whole position depends on your feeling. And if your whole position depends on your feeling, well, now I can't argue with you about anything.
That's right.
Because you don't have my feelings.
That's right.
There's no way to argue. There's no way to make a point.
Right.
There's no way to come to any sort of consensus.
Yeah. And by the way, and maybe some listening has figured this out already, this is a ripe opportunity to take the roof off. Because if we buy this point of view, there's kind of a suicide and a taking the roof off tactic in play here in this comment I'm about to make. Okay, we buy your point of view. You have this kind of, we'll call it leftist progressive point of view. I'm a conservative. What do you have to say to me? You have no idea what it's like to be me or to be a conservative. Therefore, you have no place correcting me in anything that I do that speaks from my conservative conviction. Okay, you want to play that game? That can be played in two directions.
And you know where this leads? When you say you can't understand me and I can't understand you, now what do? You can't argue. The only thing left is power.
P-O-W-E-R.
Yes.
Exactly right.
The only thing left is violence and power to get you on my, to force you to be on my side, because there's no argument that can happen.
The irony is that...
And that's what we're seeing.
Yeah, that's what we're seeing, because only one side views power as a legitimate means of getting what they want. The other side, characteristically conservatives, and I can say this not because I'm trying to politicize, this is an absolutely legitimate observation of conservatives for the last 100 years since the left started the late 19th century. It has been the left that has used power. Characteristically, there are exceptions, of course, on the right, but characteristically, it has not been part of the value system of conservatives to use power to get their way, illicitly to get their way, raw expressions of power, okay? On the left, they do it all the time. And this you can see, of course, in spades in the last 10 years. What groups block bridges, close down freeways, take over state capitals, burn cars, barricade events. It's not the conservatives. They don't believe in that. It's not their value system. It is the so-called progressives in the left who use power as a means of getting what they want. Read Saul Alinsky. you know, lessons for radicals. He's been gone a long time now, but he has schooled many of those people in leadership on the left, and they are playing out his game book.
And I think a lot of this goes back to their worldview and how they view truth and how they view tradition or, right. you know, ancient ideas and things right. like that. There's all these things play into
right.
it.
Let me add one other thought, because I don't want people to think that this is kind of a little bit of a veiled political rant here. Conservatives want to conserve. Progressives want to progress. That means they want to move past what we've had to something else. Conservatives want to conserve what we've had, because what we've had, in their view, has served us well. Okay, so what are conservatives trying to conserve? They are largely trying to conserve a way of understanding how our communities work that were built into the American experiment by people who were deeply biblically informed. Maybe not all Christians, but they were biblically informed, and then built a system that was based on a biblical view of reality. And so for me as a Christian, I am trying to conserve the biblical view of reality and the policies, the basic foundational policies that went forth from that, okay? I'm not just ranting against people who have different side politically. I think properly ought to, not always, but ought to be deeply grounded in a person's view of reality. Politics is a moral enterprise because it is principally the question of what is the right moral, right, correct, morally good use of power. Okay? And the use of power ought to be constrained by good principles. The principles that the founders had were largely Christian ones, and I want to conserve that because I think it provides the most liberty and prosperity mm-hmm. and dignity for the most people.
Okay, one more question. This is an easy one. It's from Enable.
You always say that.
You can't get this one wrong, Greg.
Okay.
This is from Enabled by Him. What is your favorite book of the Bible and why?
Well, the favorite book kind of changes from time to time. So, I mean, it's one that I may be getting the most out of. So let me just give a couple of answers. I've always liked 2 Timothy. It was Paul's last book. It's short, it's vigorous, it's to the point, and it's very practical. And it's theologically substantive about basic things. You know, guard the gospel, I take to be the theme from chapter 1, verse 14. I lately have spent a lot of time in 1 Peter, because 1 Peter is one of a number of New Testament books that have been written to suffering Christians. And so if you're experiencing a lot of hardship of different kinds, whether it's in your personal life or whether it's hardship that comes from confronting the world with the truth of Christ, that kind of overt persecution, 1 Peter's for you. And I have had a lot of challenges in the last number of years, and I find myself going to 1 Peter a lot to be encouraged. Okay? So I also think Proverbs is a fabulous book. I like it because it is a very practical, and there's a lot of wisdom in it. Not to make a joke, but it's true. You read some of these things. A harsh word stirs up anger. A gentle answer turns away wrath. That's easy to remember, and it's oh so true and so completely practical. And there are many, many, many passages I read and reread in Proverbs because they inform how I ought to live my life. So those are ones that have just books. It's hard to pick favorites because they're all God's word. You know, here's a great verse. What's wrong with the rest of them? Are they bummers or what? You know, but those are ones that at the moment, you know, are books that resonate with me a lot. I never got so much into Psalms. I characterize Psalms in the story of reality. No, in a in a piece I just wrote, Solid Ground, I deserve. Psalms are for the heart, and Proverbs are kind of for the head, I think, in a certain sense. And maybe that's why I like Proverbs better. It's easier for me to manage, given my temperament. I do spend time in the Psalms, but a lot of Psalms don't do anything for me. I end up focusing in on other Psalms that really speak my heart. You know, Psalm 51, for example. I almost got that one memorized because it's so appropriate to recite it, given one's life.
I'm sorry, Greg, but the correct answer is Romans.
Yes, ma'am.
No, I love Romans. Romans is definitely my favorite.
It's a fabulous
one.
Book. No question.
It's so theological. I mean, everything is right in there. Mm-hmm. I love it. I think it's brilliant.
I like John too, as far as the Gospels are concerned. Yeah. John is a fairly uncomplicated gospel. It's high Christology, and it's just a magnificent characterization of the person and the work of Christ. So there you go.
Thank you, Greg.
Welcome.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. Please send us your questions on Twitter with the hashtag SDRAsk. We look forward to hearing from you. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.